Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Welcome to everybody on this Easter morning. I have to say it was very inclusive of the Easter Bunny to come by early this morning and leave us chocolates on the cushion. So if you haven't before, there's a sheet at your seat, and we are on the sixth paramita. So if you would turn to that last page and read. And then when you're done, put the paper down in front of you so we all know who's finished. So we've been through all of the first five of the six paramitas, and today's paramita is wisdom. It's the sixth, and as we read the verse, without wisdom, the five paramitas cannot accomplish perfect enlightenment. Therefore, to meditate on the wisdom that is endowed with skillful means and does not conceive the three spheres is the practice of a bodhisattva. The three spheres we spoke about briefly when we talked about generosity. The three spheres in that case would be the giver, the receiver, and the action between them. And what we realize as we practice the first paramita of generosity is that as we work with that, giver and receiver, it's not so simple. They're not easily separated. One can't give something without someone to receive. You can't receive without someone to give. So they're mutually required and not really separable. And likewise, the activity is the whole reason for this get-together. So there's this dynamic quality to it. And when we really understand that, that's going beyond the three spheres, not conceiving of the three separate aspects of these activities. And that's our practice as bodhisattvas, is to move beyond that. So that's what that means. And in the third line it says, to meditate on the wisdom that is endowed with skillful means. Here, skillful means is compassionate action. Wisdom doesn't manifest without compassionate action. And in fact, it's the natural manifestation of wisdom is compassionate action, because it is based on this beyond the three spheres. How can we not contribute to the welfare of a situation where we're all intermingled? There's no way to separate out, so this is a very natural outpouring that happens in this circumstance. But the first line is interesting. Without wisdom, the five paramitas cannot accomplish perfect enlightenment. I think we could as easily say, without the five paramitas, we can't accomplish wisdom. Because without practicing in this body, in this life, in this form that we are in, we're not going to understand any of it. This is the tools that we've got to work with. So without the first five paramitas, we can't get to the last one. I think this is another way we could say this. And in the meantime, while we're working on them, we're making the world a more pleasant place, right? When we work on our conduct, even if we don't really get it, you know, selflessness is a little tricky. I get impermanence. I don't really like it. that sort of thing. So we're struggling with these concepts, and they still are mostly concepts to us. In the meantime, we can behave and carry ourselves in a way that it's just a better place to be. We can make it a better place. So that part of the journey is not at all wasted in starting out. If we don't start out, we can't get to the next stage. So you got to start somewhere. You start where you are. And that's part of wisdom. When we talk about accomplishing perfect enlightenment, we have said the paramitas mean they're translated as perfections, but that's kind of a tricky word. I see it more as transcendence, meaning we've gone beyond. We talk about going beyond the three spheres. This is also going beyond some sense of distinction between this conventional reality that most of us are in and function in all the time, and this more underlying quality, the difference between what Koshin calls self and no self, these two aspects of our life, our existence, self and no self. When we come to a transcendent place with that, we have a kind of a visceral understanding of this impermanent nature, inseparable nature, selfless nature. These aspects are not just concepts to us, but we have them in our gut. And we can move easily from that place to, here, I'll set the table, the more mundane qualities. And this is really what wisdom is to be in this transcendent space where we can move easily between what is needed moment by moment by moment. And it's informed by this deep well of no self. Starting with generosity, you know, we talked about kind of building that giving muscle by starting, you could just hand a dollar bill from one hand to the other and realize this is not as painful as you thought it might be, handing out dollar bills. And then you start looking for opportunities to be generous. You begin to realize that everything gives you an opportunity to be generous because you can have a service perspective, an offering perspective with whatever you do. And the receiver as well, that's a tricky thing to be a receiver. So we, when we really work with that practice, we realize that we are giving the giver the opportunity to give, and we are offering in that way. We don't have to feel badly about getting help and moving from that sense of help or caring for or pitying to a sense of offering is really what this is trying to get us to do. When we come from that perspective, it becomes a very joyful practice very joyful practice. So that's generosity. Ethical discipline is the next one, and here we move through looking at our own behavior and how we may be causing harm by what we do. This is really what ethics is about, is causing no harm or causing least harm. It's not about following some absolute set of rules. And it can be tricky, you know. Someone asked me about Buddhist ethics, if there were some good writings on Buddhist ethics. And basically, Buddhist ethics will say, well, it depends, you know. The rules that we have, the precepts that we have, they're not some secret Buddhist document. Everybody knows. We all have a pretty basic understanding of what's okay and what's not okay to do. The tricky part is in the gray areas, and I was thinking of a circumstance when my mother died some years ago. My sister and I were back taking care of her, and she died. And then the next day, one of the first people that showed up, small town, so the grapevine is pretty quick, was her longtime handyman, and he came to pay his respects, and then he said, I need to talk to you girls about the house, you know, because he'd been working on it for years. And okay, he said, what are you planning to do with it? Don't know yet, probably sell it. He said, okay, then you need to know this. There's termites in the porch steps. Oh, okay. He said, they've been there for 15 years. Oh, that's interesting. And he said, I pointed them out to your mother, and she said, oh, I know there are termites there. She said, they have every much right to a place to live and food as you and I, and we have an understanding. They can stay in the steps, and it's fine. But if they come in the house, we're going to have another conversation. Oh. I said, really? He said, yes. And he said, I swear to you, they have been in the steps for 15 years. They have not moved out of the steps. And he says, from time to time, I have to replace that one board, give him something else to chew on. But he said, that's what's going on with the front porch steps. He said, but now your mom's passed. He said, all bets are off. Because she's the one that made this arrangement. So he said, if you're going to sell the house, you might want to think about this. So we did. And in fact, decided, and it was not an easy decision, to exterminate the termites. Not because we wanted to do it, we wanted to get rid of them. My mother sets kind of a high bar in this sort of stuff, still does, 15 years on. But because whoever would buy the house would exterminate them for sure. Mm-hmm. We kind of owed them that. Mm-hmm. The termites at this point had a relationship with us, mm-hmm. through our mother. And so we said, okay, we'll do that. It's a funny story, of course, but it illustrates the difficulty and the not black and whiteness about so many of these decisions. That's causing harm. But every time we eat a meal, we cause harm because animals and plants are killed or exploited for our benefit. So being aware of this is really important. And as we become more and more aware of the effect that we have, we open up to our responsibility and our connection. This is what ethical discipline is about. Patience, enduring hardship, learning to respond in a more skillful way to the craziness that can happen in personal relationships. Just being able to appreciate the difficulty of being in this life, on this planet. there's a lot of aspects to that as well. And when we talk about patients, oftentimes it's in terms of working with anger, which is a very difficult thing, or with conflict. And how do we make that work? There's a great story that Sharon Salzberg tells. I love this one, and it kind of encapsulates this whole thing. She was in India, and she was training in compassion practices, and she thought, this is great. You know, I can be a really compassionate, nice person, and people will like me, and all of this. This was early on in her training, and it was monsoon season. She's walking, she has an umbrella, gave up, and called one of the tuk-tuks, the little open cabs, on a bicycle with a motor assist. Anyway, she called a tuk-tuk over and to get to her teacher's house for her next lesson. And she's got her umbrella with her. And as they were stopped in traffic at one point, a man got into the cab with them through the open sides and started to assault her. Now, the tuk-tuk driver, she didn't know what to do. Here she is doing compassion practice. How do you respond? This man is assaulting her. He's attacking her. Tuk-tuk driver booted the guy out because he figured he wasn't going to pay him. He had no interest in keeping him in there a second longer. But when Sharon was very upset, she got to her teacher and she said, what should I have done? You know, I was paralyzed in that situation. I was just paralyzed. I'm supposed to be a nice, compassionate person and, you know, care for all beings, and this guy attacked me. He said, oh, Sharon. He said, with all the loving kindness you can muster in your heart, you should have taken your umbrella and beat him over the head. And I love that story. Because sometimes that's what it takes. The point being that we're working to muster that loving kindness in our heart, to muster the ability to tolerate and be with what comes up and then respond from that depth. So that's patience, effort. One of the things that we find when we practice with effort is it's not so much that we need to keep putting in a lot of effort. There is this Koshin Lovely explanation of the rocket ship taking off. There's this initial kind of burst of energy we may need, but it carries itself. And one of the reasons that our effort carries itself when we practice sincerely is that our motivation changes over time. It changes from, I'm in pain and I need to do something about it, to I want to share this. I want to include others in this. So this motivation changes, the motivation grows, and the amount of energy we have to expend really becomes less and less. The question here is, who is putting in the effort? Over time, we draw on energy beyond ourselves. We really do. It's amazing. Meditation. Again, we start out and it's all about finding the right cushion or figuring out how long to sit. There's a lot of technical stuff that goes on, but then the shift happens where we really reap the benefit. We begin to see how calm it makes us. And over time, we let go of the sense of I am meditating, right? We just let go of all of that. All of these paramitas are a process of letting go of something. We're letting go of something. In this case, we're letting go of that sense of ourself taking up so much space. And with no fixed point, then we can shift easily with the experience. There's nobody to get upset, right? There's no ego to get caught when you get off the cushion. This is what meditation brings us, and it really, really does bring it. And over time, we find we can weather more and more emotional storms. And there's always a place where we get tripped up. I talked last night about my struggle with this one chant that we do, the Gyodo, which is very slow, very slow. But I've really come to value these little snippets of silence in between the syllables and not try to grab after the next syllable. So each of these things, we can find that we can move through it if we pay attention to it, if we put our curiosity and kindness on the situation and say, wow, what is going on? We can usually work our way through it, practicing at the edge. So how do we practice with prajna itself then? For most of us, it's simply remembering to take that broader perspective when we're struggling with a situation, to notice when we're struggling, because when we're struggling, it means we've separated ourselves out in some way. This is happening to me. That's what struggle is. This is happening to me. What can be done about it, you know? So when we see that happening, we come back to this perspective of beyond the three spheres. What is that perspective? The bigger picture, the more spacious container, the higher point of view. It doesn't mean we don't experience emotions like sorrow or anger. Emotions like opinions, thoughts, events all arise due to various causes and conditions. As long as we're in human form, this will be the case. As long as we're in human form, we will have these experiences. We wouldn't be human if we didn't have them. But we can become more and more skilled at coming back to the balance point more quickly once we find ourselves bumping against something, struggling with something, knocked down by something. We go, oh, well, that just happened. And we can come back more and more skillfully, more and more quickly, and hopefully not leave everything shattered all around us because we can't cope or we feel we can't cope. Another sign that we're moving well along this path is if we have done something that causes harm, our first reaction is to make amends, to find a way to repair the hurt in others before we even think about, that was embarrassing, you know, what am I going to do about that, my reputation, that sort of thing. We don't feel we have to save face. It's more like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I did that and I know it hurt. To be able to do that before we think of our own embarrassment or, oh, I'm supposed to be a good Zen student and I screwed up again, you know. I forgot that thing 10 times in a row. It's not a problem. Mistakes are part of it. That's part of what prajna is understanding that the whole ball of wax is included. Mistakes are included. Ignorance is included. All of these things are included. There's nothing that needs to be left out or pushed away out of the picture. Even the things that we're letting go, that we have to let go to let our true nature arise in us, not out there, but in us, all those things are still floating around. They're going to come back. That's okay. But we can deal with it. We can deal with it because we hold it all more lightly than we do. We become more and more able to discern these things. I guess I want to read the poem. I actually love this poem. I hope everyone else has enjoyed these poems as much as Koshin and I have working with them. But this one, The Fish, I'd like to read it through. The first fish I ever caught would not lie down quiet in the pail, but flailed and sucked at the burning amazement of the air and died in the slow pouring off of rainbows. This reminds me of course, my sister and I used to fish when we were young. We only caught sunnies, you know, these little tiny fish. And my father made us prepare them so that we'd eat them. The fillets were almost big. And we probably expended more calories in processing the fish than we got from eating the flesh. But I viscerally related to this poem from being instructed to do that. And also, my cousin's farm we would visit every summer, and my uncle would slaughter the animals that he raised himself. He felt he owed them that, like we owed the termites to exterminate them. And that was hard. I still can visualize the end of the summer slaughtering a calf that my cousin Margaret had named after my sister Sally. Because they both had, they had these big, beautiful brown eyes, you know, and lovely auburn hair. And we loved Sally the cow. And then Uncle Fred said, well, Sally the cow's going in the freezer for the winter. That was tough to have to slaughter Sally, you know. So a little traumatic for my sister, too. But it's part of life. It's part of life. You can't avoid it. Later I opened his body and separated the flesh from the bones and ate him. Now the sea is in me. I am the fish. The fish glitters in me. We are risen, tangled together, certain to fall back to the sea. Again, we go from this intellectual understanding of the interconnection among all of us to a more visceral, gut level understanding. It goes from our head to our gut to our bones, so we can't forget it. This is prajna. This is prajna. It's not pretty. There's no way to be a sentient being without causing harm. To realize that, that's what we're doing here. Out of pain and pain and more pain, we feed this feverish plot. We are nourished by the mystery. It is out of pain and pain and more pain. We really do experience this. And we can't paper over it. We have to go through it. Have to go through the pain. There's no way to avoid it. That's one reason why we sit silently and without moving on the cushion. It is painful. I'm going to go home and take a hot bath after this. And yet, I appreciate it so much. I appreciate it so much because it reminds me. Nobody has died in Sesshin, not at least not any of the Sesshins I've been in spite of the fact that you want to die, you think you're going to die, you want to kill the Jiki-Jitsu. All of that, these murderous kind of thoughts are going through your head. It can be a really violent practice, you know, if we're paying attention. If we're paying attention, we realize this. There's intrinsic suffering being in this samsaric realm, and yet we are nourished by the mystery. We're nourished by this deep well, this no-self, this prajna that we come in contact with when we let go, loosen up, lighten up, and face what's going on. Then we can really appreciate this precious, painful, beautiful life.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.